Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It's good to be talking with you this Monday, the first program of November 2009, and we are here in the autumn, and all kinds of things are happening, including elections in several states and municipalities tomorrow. We'll be talking about that and what it means, in particular, a big vote in Maine on the issue of same-sex marriage. But various places are voting on everything from some local ordinances having to do with anti-discrimination practices all the way to gubernatorial elections in the states of New Jersey and Virginia that are garnering a great deal of much-deserved attention. We're going to be talking today about a different matter altogether. It's something I wrote about last week. President Barack Obama is signing the legislation now to make a federal crime, a hate crime, any act that is considered to be a crime against persons based upon their gender identity, or sexual orientation. I wrote an article about this last week, and it's really important that we take a good look at it, because what we're talking about here is a huge issue where it's not only a matter of personal freedom, it's a matter of religious liberty. And beyond that, it's now a matter of consequence because of what President Obama said that went far and beyond what the law says. In signing this legislation, President Barack Obama said that he is looking forward to the time when this nation is made up of people who are free to live and love as we see fit. Now, I wrote an article about that, published it last Friday, because that is one of the most expansive and dangerous statements I've ever heard from an American president. It's hard to imagine anything more reckless, condescending, and for that matter, just, unreal than what President Obama said, because I do not believe that he means what he said. Because when he says that every citizen would be free to live and love as we see fit, well, that covers a whole lot more than what's covered in this legislation. And we're going to be talking today about why it is dangerous to talk this way and about why no one actually believes that the president means what he says. So why did he say it? We're talking today about why this makes a difference and why our public discourse on issues of sexuality, especially related to homosexuality and same-sex marriage, why that discourse, that conversation is becoming increasingly unhinged from reality, and how we regain some sense about how to even talk about the matter. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you really want to live in a country where everyone is free to live and love as he or she sees fit? That's what the president said should be our aim. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Now, today at my website at albertmohler.com, I have posted a major article entitled The Marriage Index, A Revealing Look at the Nation. If you were listening to this program last Thursday, you heard a conversation with Maggie Gallagher, who's president of the National Organization for Women. And we were talking about this project undertaken by the Institute for American Values in cooperation with the National Center for African-American Marriages and Parenting. It's called the Marriage Index. And if you were listening to the program last week, you know that we were talking about an index of leading marriage indicators that would be a parallel to what we talk about all the time in the field of economics as the index of leading economic indicators. That index is so important, it tells us whether or not we're headed into or coming out of a recession. But when it comes to the state of marriage, we haven't had anything like this until just now. And we're much in debt to the Institute for American Values and others for coming up with this kind of a marriage index. Last week, we talked to Maggie Gallagher about why our score now, given these leading indicators, is in such a perilous position. I'm very interested to say and to learn today that in Great Britain, a similar index has now been done, and I have that report before me, and it looks like in Great Britain, we're in a very similar situation to that in the United States. In Great Britain, the study was undertaken by the Jubilee Center. So there in Great Britain, not only do they have now an index of leading economic indicators, but also a marriage index as well. Their current score is 61.7. That's the average score of the percentage of adults there who are married, the percentage of adult persons who are satisfied with their marriage. the percentage of first marriages that are intact, the percentage of births to married parents, and the percentage of children living with their own married parents. Now, at my website today at albertmoeller.com, I posted a lengthy article that explains why this marriage index is so important, and that article is embedded with data that I think you will find both interesting and important. You'll find that article at albertmoeller.com, and there you'll also find the blog available in printed, and soon, a little later today, in audio form as well. Very interesting news out there. And, of course, fast on the heels of Halloween, the New York Times is out with an article published yesterday by Samuel Friedman indicating that paganism as an organized religion is becoming just another religion for academia and for the military. He starts out talking about Michael York, not the actor, but a very different Michael York, who celebrates not Halloween, but Samhain. If you see that spelled, it looks like Samhain, but it's pronounced Samhain, which is the ancient pagan ceremony upon which Halloween is based. Samuel Friedman writes in the New York Times that Mr. York has a very different way of practicing what many people would call Halloween. As night falls, it will illuminate the surrounding objects, that is a candle, tarot cards, Tibetan silver bowls, a bell and statues or icons of deities like the Greek Earth Mother Gaia and the Lithuanian thunder god Perkunas. While facing the altar, if past practice holds, Mr. York will invoke the names of the ancestors and loved ones who have died. He will often write down their names, too, and keep that piece of paper in the cabinet. The day that most Americans know as Halloween, Mr. York celebrates as Samhain, the annual autumnal new year for pagans. And for Mr. York, paganism is indeed a proper noun connoting a specific religion that he's observed for decades. Now, you want to know how organized this is? Mr. York will be planning to attend the American Academy of Religion, which is the major academic group of scholars studying religion in the United States and Canada. He's going to be in Montreal for their meeting. He is chairman of the Pagan Studies Group. He's going to present his own paper entitled Idolatry, Ecology, and the Sacred as Tangible, end quote. Now, the New York Times is on to something here, and that is the fact that paganism, in terms of its adherents, now has sufficient numbers of persons with sufficient influence to be recognized as an alternative religion. And in the military, as a matter of fact, when it comes to the symbols that are found on official military tombstones, there's now an official Wiccan or pagan symbol as well. It looks like that there may be as many as about 250,000 official pagans. However, some, such as the sociologist Helen Berger, who is doing research on pagan demography, says a more accurate number could fall between 500,000 and 1 million Americans. It's going to be very, very interesting to look at this. The fascinating part of this story to me is what comes in the middle of the story, where I read these words. In several ways, paganism was waiting for modernity to catch up with it. The emphasis on the worship of nature in virtually all variations of pagan faith and the embrace of a female divinity in many situated the religion to mesh with the environmental and feminist movements that swept through the United States in the 1970s. That's quoting from Samuel Friedman's article on paganism in Sunday's edition of the New York Times, and I really do think he's on to something, and I'll tell you, when he says that it was waiting for modernity to catch up with it, I think it's more like post-modernity, because what we're really talking about here is this idea of spirituality, that one simply customizes to one's own needs, desires, interests, and so if one is a feminist, well, the feminist-leaning New Age spirituality of ancient paganism, you can just add that to the mix. If indeed you're a radical environmentalist, well, after all, one of the most essential features of most paganism has been a worship of the earth. So it just follows that that's very convenient as you're putting together your own postmodern spirituality. Again, what we have here is something of a cultural and social and, in this case, spiritual barometer, because the New York Times taking an interest in this tells us that it's a story of some significance. This would not be the case were it the fact that this would be only a few people gathered in a few places. We're talking here about a sizable number of persons, whether it is 100,000, 150,000, 250,000, or, as this one sociologist suggested, 500,000 to 1 million persons. When you consider where they are located in terms of academia, how influential they are in terms of certain think tanks, publications, and now also in Hollywood, well, it tells you that this is the sign of what the New York Times, at least, thinks is something coming, not something going. And that's the issue. We were talking about an index of leading economic indicators, and now a marriage index of leading marital indicators. It'd be interesting to know if it were possible to come up with an index of leading spiritual indicators, what would be on it? I think it would tell us, I think this New York Times story tells us, that we're trending more and more into the postmodern weird. As Americans are defining a spirituality individually that matches their own desires, expectations, ideologies, whims, and wishes, well, it turns out it's back to the future. When you look into the mirror of that kind of spirituality, you find the old idolatry looking you right in the face. We'll be right back to talk about hate crimes legislation and the language of President Barack Obama on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We knew this was coming, and we knew it was coming last week. The hate crimes legislation expansion to include gender identity, and sexual orientation. Gender was already there, but specifically related to gender identity. We knew this was coming. It had been attached to a defense authorization bill, which made it almost inevitable, given the Democratic control of both the House and the Senate, that it would pass, and passed by a sizable majority. And so it passed from the House of Representatives last week to the United States Senate, and then from the Senate to the desk in the White House of President Barack Obama. President Obama had said as candidate Obama that he would sign the legislation if it came to his desk. It arrived there last week. He wasted no time signing it. That was expected. And there is much to talk about there, and we're going to be talking about the religious liberty ramifications of this kind of hate crimes legislation, and we have new data even today to alarm us into understanding just how real those religious liberty threats are. What we're talking about here is the psychologization of crime. When it comes to the despicable crimes that are covered by this law, we need to recognize as despicable crimes they were already covered by law. The law is called the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act, and it refers in the cases of Matthew Shepard and James Byrd to two men who were brutally attacked. They were savagely attacked and murdered, and by any standard of human morality and justice, those who did these crimes should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. As a matter of fact, if we really understand what it means to respect every human being as a human being, it means that every attack of any violence on a human being must be punished to the fullest extent of the law. President Obama said it's hard for any of us to imagine the mindset of someone who would kidnap a young man and beat him to within an inch of his life, tie him to a fence, and leave him for dead. It's hard for any of us to imagine the twisted mentality of those who'd offer a neighbor a ride home, attack him, chain him to the back of a truck, and drag him for miles until he finally died. End quote. I would go further than that and say it's not only hard for us to imagine that mindset, it's very dangerous for us to even try to imagine that mindset. It requires us to enter into a calculus of evil that is itself a dangerous complicity with sin. But nonetheless, those words were eloquent, and the president exposed the deep divide that resides in far too many human hearts. But what comes next is the logic of a hate crime, and I'll tell you why that's dangerous. It's dangerous because it shouldn't matter. The whole point of an anti-discrimination mentality should be that it doesn't matter if the crime is against a woman or a man, against the young or the old, against the rich or the poor. It shouldn't matter that a crime of violence in this case, and it wouldn't have to be a violent crime, but usually in getting this kind of law passed, reference is made to violent crimes for obvious reasons. It wouldn't have to be, but you look at any kind of violent crime, it shouldn't matter why it was done. What the law should concern itself with is the crime itself. And what we have here is the extension of special protections to persons of particular groups who are now identified as those who will be covered by the protection of hate crimes, so that anyone who does such a thing against these persons is punished to a greater degree than had the crime been against someone else. And I'm going to argue that a crime against a homosexual person is no more immoral than a crime against a heterosexual person, or vice versa. And to extend that logic, well, as an editorial in the Harvard Crimson said just in the last day or so, how about ideology? How about when someone disagrees with someone politically and it's motivated by a hatred that's based in that disagreement? How is that any less morally significant here? And that's the kind of question that the whole idea of hate crimes legislation brings up. And then on the religious liberty angle, that too is huge. I want to tell you why. In Great Britain, let me just mention a name to you. The name of this grandmother is Pauline Howe, H-O-W-E. She's a grandmother who wrote a letter that was published, I believe, in the newspaper, complaining about a local gay pride march in her town there in Great Britain. She attracted widespread media coverage because she received a warning from the local police. Now, listen to this. This was the warning. This was in Norwich. She received a warning letter from the Norwich City Council and a visit from the Norwich police stating that she might have committed a hate crime by merely writing a letter protesting a gay pride march. Now, that's scary. And we're not talking here about something that's hypothetical. This has already happened in Canada with prosecutions. It has already happened in Great Britain with arrests, citations, and prosecutions. And now we're talking about a grandmother who has been being warned that she may have committed a hate crime simply for writing a letter complaining about a local gay pride march. That's the logic of this kind of hate crime mentality. You know, you're reading minds, and then you're looking for evidence of hate, and any kind of disagreement comes down to being defined as hate. That's a significant issue, and of course there are religious liberty issues here, because as Christians speak about, for example, homosexuality is sin, does that represent a hate crime? Now, those who passed and pressed for this legislation say there is nothing in this law that makes that a hate crime. Well, let me tell you, there is nothing in this law that keeps that logic from being extended by others to this being considered a hate crime. Or to a preacher, for instance, preaching against homosexuality, someone hears him, could be someone listening on the radio, and goes and commits a crime, and thus there is now a conspiracy, or at least a complicity that can be argued. And again, these are not just hypothetical cases. These are the kinds of things that are now becoming a matter of police action, arrest and prosecution in various places around the world. But that's not my main interest, even in having this discussion today. All of that would be worthy of this discussion. It took place last week, at the end of the week. The president signed this on Thursday. I wrote my article on Friday. This is the first opportunity after that for us to have the conversation. And we're going to be talking about something that surprised me in the midst of this. All that that has been said was unsurprising. We knew that was coming along. The hate crimes legislation was in cycle. The House had passed it. It was before the Senate. We knew it was going to pass. Once both the House and Senate had passed it, we knew the president was going to sign it. And he signed it. It's what the president said when he signed it that caught my attention. That's what surprised me. In lengthy comments, the president made a statement about his support for this act and its historical importance, but then he went on to say something that went far beyond anything any president has ever said. This is what he said. He said, time and time again, the measure was defeated or delayed. Time and again, we've been reminded of the difficulty of building a nation in which we're all free to live and love as we see fit. End quote. Now, I heard those words, and I'll tell you the truth. I wondered if I had heard them correctly. I went and checked. You can check my article published on Friday, and I'll give you the link in that article directly to the White House. You can read the president's own transcript of his comments. He said that our goal is the building of a nation in which we're all free to live and love as we see fit. Who's the we're all there? This legislation covers gender identity and sexual orientation. Well, get us out of the hate crime context for just a moment and consider the president's utopian dream. A dream of a nation in which we're all, that's what he said, free to live and love as we see fit. Well, there's a polygamous trial going on in Texas. I guess the president's vision is that that should not take place. Incest? I mean, the range of sexual orientations found among contemporary Americans is vast. I'll tell you the truth, I don't think the president meant that. But the president did say that. And I want to know what you think about it. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The whole idea of hate crimes legislation is based in a modern confusion. And let's just name it for what it is. The modern confusion is this. We are afraid that if we do not isolate certain groups and make clear that they're deserving of protection, that they will not be protected. But let's just point out that this is a law that is named for two very specific human beings, Matthew Shepard and James Byrd. And those who did such crimes were prosecuted under laws that already existed. And that's why what we're really looking at here is this kind of modern confusion that leads persons to believe we need to actually psychologize these crimes. Because in a postmodern society, we want to isolate thoughts. That is the urge that's going on here, is to isolate untoward thoughts, illegitimate thoughts. And just notice what kinds of thoughts are involved here. The thought of violence, yes, we all need to recognize that for what it is. Let's criminalize violence. But we don't criminalize everyone thinking about violence. We criminalize those who perform a violent act. And that's why this hate crimes legislation is so dangerous, because it really isolates just a few groups and says, all right, we're actually going to criminalize the psychology here, not just the criminology of the act, not just the violence of the act, not just the act itself. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We will be talking about this today, if not for any other reason than the importance of considering what hate crimes legislation really means and looking, for instance, at that case of the grandmother in Great Britain who's already been warned that she may have committed a hate crime. But we're talking about it today for the very specific reason that in signing the legislation, President Barack Obama went far beyond the context of hate crimes, and he talked about his vision for America. And when he talked about his vision for America, he spoke about a nation in which we're all free to live and love as we see fit. Now, the problem is, of course, that the we are all there, we're all, well, that includes a vast number of human beings with all kinds of sexual proclivities. We're all free to live and love as we see fit. Let me just make one blanket statement. I'll stand by this so long as I have breath. There is no sane society that allows everyone to live and love as he or she sees fit. That's a dangerous statement, all the more dangerous because it was spoken by a president of the United States. And all the more dangerous because this has elicited very little conversation among the American people who evidently weren't listening or didn't think that the president meant what he said. Whether he meant it or not, I'm fairly certain he did not mean it. He did say it. And those kinds of words entered into our public discourse are very dangerous. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Let's go to Gary, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Gary.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. I'm calling to respectfully disagree with you. Our president had ample time to review the legislation before he signed it. This is the most liberal president we've ever had in our history, and I believe he meant exactly what he said.
Gary, you know, I think he meant to cover the kinds of things that most Americans thought he meant to cover, but I'll tell you the truth, and we may disagree here, and you may be making a point contrary, or you may be making a point of emphasis here, but I don't think the president's ready to stand in front of the American people and say, let's decriminalize polygamy. Let's apologize to Utah for requiring them to criminalize polygamy before they could enter the union. I don't think he intends to stand before the American people and say, I want to decriminalize incest, consensual incest. And one of the points I make in my article is that in this postmodern age of moral relativism, the only moral issue that is important to many people is consent. Well, there's nothing wrong with, say, a brother and a sister beyond the ages of childbearing, offering consent, if you follow the line that consent is the only sexual moral criterion. And I don't believe for a moment it is. Gary, I think you're right about the recklessness here. I really do. I fear you're right that the president may have meant far more than Americans heard. I don't think he meant everything that he said here. Or if he did, I'm quite certain America wasn't listening. That's why we're talking about it today. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is dangerous stuff. It's dangerous in the first stage because it moves from act to psychology. And let me just warn you, there's no way that hate crime can be lastingly separated from hate speech as a category. But to add insult to injury, the president made a statement here about his vision for America that goes so far beyond what I think Americans heard him to say. I just have to wonder if America's listening to their president. I think you better be. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with more calls.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We are discussing the president's words as he signed this hate crimes extension, federal extension of the categories for hate crimes legislation to include gender identity and sexual orientation. Huge steps. This has been one of the major goals of the gay rights movement for a very long time. This is a prize that they have finally won. And the president went far beyond, however, the legislation. He went far beyond the context of speaking about hate crimes. He spoke about his vision for America. And in speaking about what he wants America to be, he spoke of a nation in which we're all free to live and love as we see fit, end quote. And I find that to be some of the most frightening and worrisome language ever spoken by an American president. Because the we're all free to live and love as we see fit is not only a subversion of marriage and heterosexuality, it's a subversion of any norm whatsoever in human sexual behavior. Any norm. Free to live and love as we see fit, that means there are no norms. Nothing is disallowed. Now, as I wrote my article and I've said already in this program, and I want to stipulate again, I don't believe that President Barack Obama actually believes that. I haven't even met anyone, any sane person who actually believes that, but he did say it. And we're talking about it today because it's now an argument that is in play in the public square. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska. Dick's on the line. Go ahead.
Hello, Albert. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I agree with you, except that I do believe that the president does mean what he says, that he wants to change the law and he wants to make special things for special groups of people. That's what I think his intent is. And, of course, that's just my viewpoint of it. I don't think anything has to be changed. I think we have the laws in the books. If someone violates the law, it should be punished accordingly. It doesn't have to mean, I agree with you, it doesn't have to be a special group of people get special treatment and somebody gets punished more because they do something against a special group.
Okay, I appreciate the call. I agree fundamentally that we have no need of psychologizing these crimes. A crime is a crime. No one looking at the crimes the president referred to last Thursday would say that's not a crime. As a matter of fact, I agree wholeheartedly when the president spoke so eloquently of the violence in the human heart that led to the attacks upon these two men, Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. But even as the president said these things, there have been criminal prosecutions already because of the crimes themselves. Now we're talking about the extension of a psychological blanket of protection. And I do find that very, very dangerous. And, of course, if you're going to do that, you have to identify which special groups are going to deserve this protection. And they're pretty much going to be the usual suspects here, the usual kinds of groups that demand that kind of coverage. What about an assault made upon an evangelical church? What about an assault, that is made upon, for that matter, and by the way, they would say that's covered by religious discrimination, where they say, by religion. But what if it's not a church? What if it's just a couple? What if it's just someone that sends, like this grandmother, a letter that says, I think we should not have had this gay pride march, and next thing you know, she's being warned that she, quote, may have committed a hate crime. Let's go to Nick calling from Salem, Oregon, listening on KPJC. Go ahead, Nick.
Well, you bring up an interesting point about free speech now because it's getting less free all the time. But I believe also that the bigger concern here is the demoralization of the American fiber in that when we have to bring this stuff to the dinner table, we have to have these types of discussions and also to have American law, I guess, lift up this, you know, this group of people who want to be have special treatment. It also adds validity to what they're doing to the untrained eye.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Nick, that's a very important point. When you identify a group like this and you stipulate federal protection, a very special protection, you are legitimating and normalizing their behavior. And that's exactly what the president did. And I really appreciate the way you drew the line from the one to the other, because the president's words do emphatically make that point. He emphatically does want an America in which being gay is just not an issue. And from a secular viewpoint, I'm sure to the president that makes sense. Given his mentality, his ideology, his worldview, I'm sure that makes sense. I'm sure that's consistent with who he is and how he thinks. But it already is known to us that that is not consistent with the vast majority of the people in the United States. We already know. We know by vote after vote after vote, survey after survey, we know by conversing with our neighbors that that is not where Americans are. Now, of course, that begs the question of what's fundamentally and objectively right and wrong. But at the very least, it tells us that this president has set himself far to the left of the American people by what he does mean by these words, not to mention what we at least hope he doesn't mean. Nick, you're exactly right. And there's an intimidation factor here. We just need to name that for what it is. When the president uses language like this, it is an explicit, intentional effort to make those who disagree with him look immoral, look less committed to nonviolence, less committed to the respect of every single human being. A part of why we as Christians have such a stake in this is because we believe the human dignity is inseparable from our sexuality. We believe the human dignity is tied to the fact that we are created by an omnipotent creator who made us in his image. And even as he made us in his own image, he also addressed us with a law. He gave us rules that are not just to bind us in, but are to free us for ultimate human happiness and ultimate human dignity. Whenever we rebel against that, we actually compromise that dignity. And that's exactly why we're so concerned. We're not concerned just with telling people no. We're concerned with keeping them from harm. And I'm sure the president thinks that in signing this legislation, he's keeping people from harm. Very interesting. Let's just give him that due. Let's just assume, as I think we're honor-bound to assume, that the president of the United States and those legislators in the Senate and the House who voted for this think that in taking this act, in approving this bill, in signing this legislation, they were taking a significant step to protect human beings. I'll concede them that motivation. I will not concede them that effect. I believe that what they have done is to put human beings, very real human beings, you and I know and love, and persons beyond us we will never see, I think they have put them not at less risk, but at greater risk. Because they have now been validated in what we believe, based upon the Word of God, is not only sinful, but by definition a deeply injurious behavior. We'll be right back with final thoughts. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. Sanford's been waiting on the line, listening on WFIA in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Sanford.
Well, Dr. Mueller, I look at the legislation being passed, and I see that that becomes the stepping stone for further legislation, which, like your last caller talked about, is chipping away at our rights. I believe the legislation is going to be forcing us into a smaller and smaller, more acceptable behavior pattern, which is going to be dictated by these groups that are getting the laws passed.
Yeah, it's a very good point, Sanford, and I think you've put your finger on exactly what the goal is. The goal is to create a new normal, and the law is the instrument for doing that. The law is not the only instrument. The media is a powerful tool that is shaping public opinion. You have a very clear effort to reach the minds of children especially those in the public schools where there is a pool of young minds who can easily be impressed. And what we've noticed from groups like GLSEN and others is that they're actually saying to kids, your parents are likely to be very prejudiced. You're just going to have to learn how to think very differently than your own parents and don't listen to them on issues like this. This is really frightening stuff out there. And, of course, this hate crimes legislation, and I made the point earlier, there is no way that this does not implicate hate speech eventually. There's no way. You just cannot stop the logic at this point, as those who press for this legislation understand. And it is to create a smaller box of acceptable behavior. But more than that, a smaller box of acceptable speech, a smaller box of acceptable thoughts, a smaller box of acceptable public arguments. You know, one of the things we're going to be talking about tomorrow is what is going on in California, now in Washington State, and also in the state of Maine. There have been citizen initiatives. It's a big one, big vote tomorrow in Maine on same-sex marriage. About last November, it was California, Proposition 8, and in Washington State on the what's called Everything But Marriage bill. There are referenda in those three places, California already over, Washington, and, of course, Maine tomorrow. And those who are pressing the gay rights agenda have demanded the lists of the petitions with the names and phone numbers of those who signed the petitions in order, very explicitly, they'll be right up front and say this, to bring public pressure against those who signed the petitions calling for Proposition 8, calling for the repeal of the same-sex marriage law in Maine, calling for opposition to what's going on in Washington in the Everything But Marriage same-sex unions bill. Folks, this kind of public pressure is exactly where this is going. And we're not just drawing this out of the air as we're trying to read minds. No, this is exactly what they have said they intend to do. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.